Good morning, and welcome to another episode of Crime Over Coffee. We're your host. I'm Abby.
And I'm Erica. And today I'm going to be telling you guys about the disappearance of Daniel Robinson.
Today I am drinking, well, I don't entirely know. Some type of fruity beer from a Columbus brewery, but I honestly don't remember what it is. I think it's from Land Grant, but it's pretty good. It's pretty good.
Nice. I am drinking a hot tea. It's white hibiscus and peach with a little bit of honey in it because it sounded good.
So grab whatever you're drinking and let's dive on in.
Daniel Robinson was a 24-year-old geologist who was last seen in Tempe, Arizona on June 23rd, 2021. His case is honestly not one that's been talked about a whole lot, so I don't have much background information on him. He is an African-American male who, like I said, was 24 years old and a geologist. At the time of his disappearance, to kind of describe him, I mean, he had dark hair. I do not know if he had any like tattoos or anything like that. When I say that there is minimal information about his disappearance and his life in general, I mean, there is quite literally very minimal information. One thing that would kind of stand out about Daniel that would make it a little bit easier to determine that it's Daniel that you're seeing was that he was missing his hand on his right arm. So that's to give you guys a little bit of a description about him. I don't know much about his personality or his past other than the ages. What had happened for his disappearance was on June 23rd, 2021, he was leaving his job site near Sun Valley Parkway just after 9 a.m. and he never made it home. I saw some mixed reviews, but there were some things that said that nobody was able to actually verify that he left at 9 a.m. That was just kind of the guess based on the work that he was doing there. But either way, the evening comes around and Daniel doesn't get home. And so his father, David, ends up filing a missing report on Daniel that same day around 7 p.m. The Buckeye police pretty quickly go out and search near the job site and they enter him into the National Missing Persons Database pretty quickly, which is rare in these types of cases. But in this time around, they did. According to Daniel's father, David, he said that he had talked to Daniel on the phone for about 2 hours, about 2 days before he went missing. And one of the things that Daniel was talking to David about was how he knew this young lady. And he was kind of, Daniel was filling David in on it, but there wasn't a whole lot that really came about from this conversation that's released to the public. I saw some misconceptions as well. There were some news articles that said that Daniel was talking about how much he was in love with this woman that he didn't know. And his father, David, is like, I never told police that he told me he was in love with this girl. He never said that to me, and I didn't tell police. And so he's not sure where the news articles got it from, which I'm sure happens a lot in these cases, right? Like, a lot of misconstrued information is always brought out. Pretty quickly after the disappearance and the missing persons report was filed, they brought David and Daniel's sister into an interrogation room at the police station and had them sit in there for a while and try to, like, come up with any sort of behavior that would seem odd or strange for Daniel in the last few days. Because at this point, based on everything I've mentioned, they didn't have much to go on other than the fact that he was last seen at his job site around potentially 9 a.m. or believed to have been there around 9 a.m. And then he just wasn't seen again. One of the things that Daniel's sister told police was that she had seen her brother staring off at a wall for like a long period of time, just a couple weeks before disappearing, kind of like he was zoned out. But it wasn't something that she'd normally seen. And so that was potentially something that was a little odd or strange, but they weren't really able to come up with anything more than this very basic information. The next day, on June 24th, 2021, the site's still being searched. They're looking around. They access the Uconnect system in Daniel's missing vehicle, which was a Jeep, and they find no GPS data. And so they're like, that doesn't help us. They try to ping his cell phone. They cannot get a location. They go and check out his apartment. There's nothing there that sets them off or gives them any sort of information. And over the next few weeks, they are conducting aerial searches with a helicopter. They're doing ground searches. They are continuing to search Daniel's apartment and the specific job site that he was at. And it's like multiple of these searches. So there's a helicopter from here and a helicopter from here, and it's going on for multiple weeks. They also sit down with Daniel's family and start going over his financial records to see if there's anything that kind of stands out there that could give them an indication on potentially where Daniel would have gone. But at this time, they're really not getting anything. One of the things that David also mentioned is that around this time when they were investigating Daniel's apartment, they noticed that his apartment had been ransacked, and that one of the things that this person had done was get into his computer. And because of this ransack, David had all of his electronics like turned over to the Tempe Police Department to do forensics on it to see if they could come up with any sort of evidence. And all that they were able to find was that somebody was looking through his computer and searching through his Google history. And he obviously found that incredibly weird that after Daniel went missing, somebody broke into his apartment specifically to look for what he'd previously been searching.
To me, that kind of points to it being somebody who knew him.
Absolutely. And unfortunately, police did not see it that way. So, like I said, police are still not convinced that it's somebody that knows Daniel. And at this point, they're not even convinced that it's foul play. They're thinking that Daniel left on his own accord.
I can't say that surprises me at all.
Really? With how many cases we've done where police immediately are like, this person is in danger, we need to find them? This is the one where you're like, eh.
Right, obviously. Police never think that, ever. No,
absolutely never. But in this case, they do, believe it or not. So they are convinced that Daniel just left on his own. His father, David, is like, no, something happened. We need to find my son. And on July 19th, 2021, they end up finding Daniel's Jeep in a ravine less than 3 miles from the job site. And his Jeep is found crashed, basically, and on its side. Well, not basically crashed, but actually crashed, but then also flipped on its side. And so they were able to get, like, Daniel's cell phone was in there. His personal items were in there. There was no concern at this point that he'd really, like, walked away with his belongings. And so they start to process his Jeep for evidence, and they continue to look through it. They're not immediately seeing anything of concern.
I'm going to go ahead and guess he wasn't in there, though.
No, Daniel was not in there. And obviously that was concerning, because now not only like do they have his vehicle, but now they have even less of an idea of where he is, because how far could he have gotten without his vehicle? During this time, they're still going through financial transactions, trying to keep an eye on it to see if anything comes up, especially now that his vehicle's crashed and he's gone, his personal items are gone. Then on July 29th, so this is 8 days after they found his Jeep, one of the volunteer searchers ends up finding a skull. And so they very quickly rush it to do testing. And determined that the skull does not belong to Daniel. So police are once again at a loss. They have no idea where to go at this point because they've got a missing person, a found vehicle that's crashed, all of their personal items still there, no hits in the financial records, and now another skull. And I'm going to be honest, I did not try to look and see if they figured out who this other skull belonged to or where that specifically leads. But what I do know, like I said, is that it did not belong to Daniel. So police are continuing to conduct interviews from friends, family, co-workers, all the people. And then they're also still doing multiple ground searches, especially in the area that the vehicle is now found. And they kind of have that 3-mile radius at that point from the job site to the crash site. And so they're kind of searching all of that area and they're not finding anything. Then in October, they finally get the collision report back, which Abby and I have talked about before, and it's super cool. The technology that vehicles and planes and all, like, everything has now, that it's able to kind of determine what happened right before the crash. I think it's called a black box, right? Yeah. Abby's shaking her head. Yes.
I mean, that's at least what it is for airplanes. I don't know if it has a slightly different name for cars or not, but...
That's right. This is the conversation. Okay, so something along the lines of that. So they look at this report, basically, and it determines that his Jeep was involved in a rollover crash, and it's the only crash recorded in the vehicle system. The speed that is caught on the... We're going to call it the black box. I apologize if that's the wrong name. The speed that is caught on the black box shows that right before the crash, the speed increased, which investigators were like, that could be that, like, could indicate that he was trying to drive up the side of the ravine or trying to crash, or there's all these different ideas at this point, right? They also were able to report that there were 40 ignition cycles recorded after the crash, which would just basically be somebody trying to restart the vehicle or to use the electrical systems after the crash had occurred, which is quite a few. So in theory, that tells us that after Daniel had crashed, he was still okay enough to try to restart the vehicle. But one of the questions that I have, I guess, is if he rolled over. And I mean, the pictures that we'll post on our Instagram, his car is quite literally on the side of, like, there's no starting that thing back up. And it's, when I say, like, a ravine, like, there's this giant dip and the hood is on one part and the bumper's on the other, and then the whole middle of the car is just kind of like floating above the divot. So he wasn't going anywhere.
Right. The only thing I could think of is if he's trying to get it going for some type of either heat or air, or maybe he had one of the buttons where you could call for help. You know, like, I've got one in my car. I don't know if it actually works or it's hooked up to anything. But if he had some kind of OnStar? I don't know which one it is. But you know what I mean. Those buttons.
OnStar. But also, typically, those automatically go off with vehicles nowadays, like, when the crash happens. So he wouldn't have necessarily needed to turn the car on in order to do that. But it is possible that he was trying to turn on for that reason. The other thing...
But I didn't know that, so maybe he's dumb like me and thought he had to have it on for it.
You know what? That's fair. All right. I rest my case. No. The other thing that was shown in the report was that there was an 11-mile discrepancy between the report and the odometer. And they thought that was kind of weird because the reports from the internal box is getting one number and the other one's getting 11 miles different, which is weird. But there was a note that apparently this has been noted by multiple Jeep dealership service departments and other crash reconstruction. So it's possible that it was kind of more of a glitch than something to be concerned about or to be tipped off about. So David ends up hiring a private investigator. And I don't know exactly what point he comes into the case, but his name is Jeff McCrath. And he's a retired police officer who specializes in collision evidence. And immediately he comes in and he's like, that 11-mile discrepancy is huge. And it tells me that the crash was deliberately set up. He also noted that the Jeep had red paint transferred onto it. And so he was like, this would suggest that he was in a prior collision before ended up in the ravine. I don't know if there's a way, I'm not a crash or collision evidence specialist, but I mean, my car has a lot of random, like, cars just get dings on them, especially like in parking lots and stuff. So I would be curious to know if there's a way specifically to determine if the transfer came from a crash or if it came from just like something small, or was there like a small crash that had previously occurred in that Jeep and there was just some red paint left over from that,
or if there's even a way to determine the time that that transfer happened.
Yeah, I don't know if there's a way to be like, no, this occurred a year ago, or nope, this is fresh, it just happened. So I'm not sure.
And then just something else, and this is going to be a little bit of a plug for a future episode coming up where we're interviewing Bob Cyphers on the I-70 serial killer. That's an unsolved case. But there is a thing for DNA that is called like a touch transfer, and you can identify DNA through that. So I wonder in what ways that relates to touch transfer in terms of not DNA, but this kind of material. So I'm sure there's just a whole science to it that's obviously above Erica and I's head because we don't know anything about that. But it's so great that there's people in the field that are experts in these specific things.
I also, and I know I've said it, but I think it's so incredibly cool that this is where we're at with forensics and with testing, I mean, red paint transfer and all these different things. The ability that we have, or that, you know, the right people have to be able to test all of this is really incredibly cool. The other thing that really gets me, that confuses me and makes me question the whole crash thing, is that there was a rancher that is the one that discovered Daniel's Jeep out in the ravine. And he was the one that called police and said, hey, I found this crashed car and there's nobody here. So the private investigator, Jeff, ends up talking with this rancher, and this rancher is like, I think police are kind of wrong, because I was out in the ravine on July 17th looking for my cattle. And so he says that it was July 17th. He went out in the ravine and was looking for his cattle, and then a few days, and there was no vehicle there. But then he went back a few days later and the vehicle was there. And if you guys remember, Daniel went missing June 23rd. So it was almost a month later that the rancher was out there and there was no Jeep. And then a couple days after he was out there, he went back out there and then suddenly the Jeep was there. So it does leave the question of, where was Daniel that whole month? Or at the very least, where was his Jeep for that month? Honestly, there's not a whole lot of information after that, and I feel bad to like give you guys that, but you'll see here in a minute why I'm bringing attention to this case specifically. Over the next few months, the police continued to do their, I guess, due diligence sort of in searching the area and testing different human remains that were found, but nothing has ever been able to be connected to Daniel. They also brought the FBI in to try to help, and that got them nowhere. In February of 2023, they ended up getting a report from somebody that there were some potential human remains inside of a well. And so they went and did like a 3-day search on that area to try to see if they could get it, because this well was about a half mile north of where Daniel was last seen. But they dug all the way down like almost 1,000 feet to see if they could find anything, and there were no human remains. The next and really last update is June of 2023. There was an updated police report that comes out that has some information that's different than what the initial police report said. And one of the things that they said they discovered and put out in this is that his cell phone was at the crash site around 10:05 a.m. and his phone stopped pinging at 10:30 a.m. But there's a witness that claims he saw Daniel around 11:30 a.m. that morning. So an hour after the supposed crash happened, he claims he saw him. And police are not sure how they feel about that witness statement.
That's weird, because then that would mean he was just like hiding out somewhere or held captive somewhere for a month, right?
His cell phone was found at, or was pinging at the crash site on the day that he disappeared at that time. Whether or not that's when the crash occurred, it's just his phone was pinging at 10:05 and then stopped at 10:30, and then a witness said he saw him at 11:30. The updated police report also talked about some of the Google searches that had recently happened for Daniel leading up to his disappearance, and some of the quotes of things that he was looking up were, quote, love changed me, unquote, quote, delete Instagram account, end quote, quote, shooting Tempe, end quote, quote, explosion, end quote, and quote, I'm okay to do things I hate, end quote. If you guys want to try to decipher that, I have no idea.
That is absolutely a random grouping of things that you could probably find in my history search. You know what I mean? Like, maybe that was a song he was trying to search, the last one.
Yes.
And newsfeed stuff.
Yes.
Like, to me, that could be something, but it absolutely could be nothing related.
I agree. You and I have talked about it time and time again. You know, if anybody went through our search history, there would be some major concern. And I search random things, and like, I don't always type in full sentences when I do searches either. So if I was trying to look up the name of a song, I might only put the lyrics in. Or like, he put shooting Tempe. Maybe he was looking for a shooting range, or he was looking for like about a shooting that previously happened. Like, there's all these different things that he could have been looking up. And I honestly, my search history would probably look very similar, and people would be very confused. So, if anybody has information on this disappearance, they can call the Buckeye Police tip line at 623-349-6411. But, as I mentioned to you guys, there was a specific reason that I was kind of doing this case, even with the little evidence that there is, or the little information. And that's because his father, David Robinson, is very, very actively trying to get Daniel's case out there, as he feels the police department has given up on his son and has not done a lot of searching like they claim they have. And a lot of this, he believes, is due to the color of his son's skin. So, I want to read, well, there's a petition that I went ahead and signed. And this petition is really just to get some information out there. Like, the point of his petition is to remind police that they need to continue to search for his son and to be aware of missing people in the area and to give everybody the same chance, right, when they go missing. So this petition was started in 2021 and it has 131,000 signatures on it. But if you guys want to sign it as well, go ahead. The link will be in our show notes. I do have a short, he has a longer explanation on the petition site that explains really why he's doing it. But I have a brief part section that I'm going to read to you guys, just that kind of discusses the point of the petition. And so it says, quote, my name is David Robinson II, and I'm the father of the geologist Daniel Robinson, who has been missing in Buckeye, Arizona since June 23rd, 2021. From the first day I arrived in Phoenix, Arizona, I have done more to find my son than the law enforcement agency, whose jurisdictional authority covers where he was last seen and where his vehicle was recovered. The Buckeye Police Department investigation has not gathered any evidence of its own. They are unwilling to move beyond their theory which leads to non-action on their part. This petition is another step in holding the Buckeye Police Department accountable to ensure this case is taken seriously. We have done a total of 49 searches that have recovered human remains, hopefully bringing closure to other families. My public searches are coming to their completion, and the Buckeye Police Department has a responsibility to continue. This petition will ensure that this happens. I need your support in my efforts for justice for Daniel and my advocacy to change laws and policies that govern mishandling and missing person cases. Please add your voice to this petition. It helps when I approach officials that can make changes. Thank you, David Robinson II. He also, he has a website, pleasehelpfinddaniel.com. He has a YouTube channel that's very active that he continues to talk on and bring information and bring awareness to Daniel's case. But he also has a tip line set up that you guys can call if anybody has any information on where Daniel may have gone or anything regarding to the crash that day. If you want to call that tip line, it is 844-602-0660.
Thanks for listening to this week's episode of Crime Over Coffee. You can find us on Instagram at Crime Over Coffee or on Facebook at Crime Over Coffee Podcast, where all of our photo and video content for each episode can be found. You can also email us your thoughts and case suggestions at crimeovercoffeepod@outlook.com. All of our sources can be found in the show notes for each episode. If you would like, you can support us by going to anchor.fm/crimeovercoffee. You can also support us by recommending us to friends and family, giving us a good review on Apple Podcasts, or subscribing to us on your favorite podcast listening platform. Thanks again, and we'll see you next time.